So, Matthew 16, verse 13. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "What about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, and you do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. Truly, I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." In 1543, the astronomer Nicholas Copernicus published a book called The Revolution of the Heavenly Planets. Ordinarily, a book published by an obscure Polish scientist in the 16th century wouldn't really affect the course of human history, nor would you and I be likely to remember it or even have read it. But the book was revolutionary, because in it, Copernicus argued that the sun did not revolve around the earth, as had been thought for centuries. In fact, it was the other way around. The earth revolved around the sun, along with all the other planets in the solar system. Now, others had suggested this theory generations before, but none had done it to the same effect. And the effect on Copernicus's book was revolutionary on the way we understand the solar system and how our planet works. The Earth is no longer at the center. The sun is. And so the book was so significant, the phrase Copernican revolution has come to mean a significant change in thinking and actions in any matter, not just astronomy. Now, what we're going to see this morning is the need for you and for me to have a Copernican revolution in our thinking when it comes about God. Because we human beings, naturally speaking, think the world revolves around us. What we're going to see, though, is the world revolves around Jesus. He is the center of the universe. He is, therefore, or at least should be, the very center of our lives. Because when we see who Jesus is, we see there has to be a Copernican revolution of enormous proportions in the way we view the world, from us to Jesus. And when we see that, then it will mean a very different way of living and thinking to what we had previously. Now, if you've been here with us these last few weeks, you'll know these central chapters of Matthew's gospel are those we've been studying. And Matthew has consistently shown all the way through Jesus' authority and his power over all things and all people. But now it is crunch time, and he asks us to make a decision which will change the way we view ourselves and the world. It will change the person at the center of our universe. So let's dive in, and Matthew is going to ask us four questions first. Will you submit to Jesus's majesty? Will you submit to Jesus's majesty? That's the heart of the question Jesus asks his disciples in verses 13 to 17. Now, you'll notice in verse 13 that Jesus and his disciples are in Caesarea Philippi. We're actually back in the very north of the country. It's part of the country that had a big Gentile, non-Jewish population. This place, Caesarea Philippi, was a Roman settlement. It was the heart of a cult that was based on the Roman Emperor Caesar. Actually, it's pretty significant that Jesus is asking his disciples this question here, because the strong local message is Caesar is king, Caesar is the boss, whereas we're going to discover someone else is actually the boss. Let's read from verse 13. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." So says Jesus, I want to ask you a question, verse 13. Who do people say I am? It's not as if Jesus is having an identity crisis. He needs some reassurance. No, this is a hugely significant moment in Matthew's gospel, because Matthew has been building the evidence for Jesus's identity all along. And now Jesus says, okay, who do people say I am? And at this point in the gospel, the tone will change from who is Jesus to what has he come to do? And the answers the disciples give show, well, some confusion. They say, well, some people say you're John the Baptist. John is dead. Jesus is John come back to life. Maybe he's Elijah, the great Old Testament prophet. But actually in chapter 11, John the Baptist, we discover from Jesus himself, is the new Elijah. Not literally Elijah reborn, but John is the promised Elijah figure, the forerunner for the Messiah. He will prepare the hearts of the people for the coming of the Messiah. Jesus isn't Elijah, John is. Maybe he's another prophet like Jeremiah. Well, that's all fine and good, says Jesus, but what about you? Verse 15, who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. It's very important to see that Jesus will not allow the disciples to give him the answers of other people. They have to answer for themselves. And Peter leads the way. You're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. In other words, you are that awesome, majestic rescuer promised in the Old Testament, the King. The Son of God, the Son of the God of the universe, not some sort of tin pot deity contained in the temple over there, the emperor's temple, or the Greek god Pan, whose shrine was at Caesarea Philippi at the time. In fact, you can still go and see the ruins today. No, Jesus is the Son of the living God. Pan and Caesar are long gone. Jesus is king. That's you, says Peter. And actually, all Peter is doing is putting into place all the evidence that we've seen over the last few months in Matthew 14 to 16. Jesus is the one who has fed thousands, miraculously, twice in fact. He's walked on water. He's calmed a storm. He's healed hundreds. He's cured a woman's daughter of demon possession. He's taught with extraordinary authority. The religious teachers can't match him. Again and again and again, Jesus teaches and acts with authority that cannot be explained. He's in a completely different category. He's not a magician. He's not a good moral teacher. He's not a political revolutionary. He is the Son of the living God, God in the flesh, come to save his people. And that's just a culmination of all Matthew has been teaching us from Matthew chapter 1, if you have eyes to see. Now, that question, who do you say I am, is not just a question that Jesus asks his disciples. It is a question for us as well, none of us can escape his question. Why? Because Jesus is the God of the universe. And one day we will have to answer that question. But it's far better to answer it before we meet him face to face, because then, well, we'll know for sure, and it'll be too late. But again and again in my line of work, I find it's a question many are unwilling to answer, even in the face of the evidence. But for us, hearing this teaching week in, week out, we have no excuse. We can't snub Jesus or fob him off. Who do you say I am? Asks Jesus. Maybe you need more time or more evidence. Perhaps you've just come this morning and you're not sure the answer to that question. That's okay if you're honest about that. One of us can sit down with you and take you through the evidence. But just remember the Pharisees and the Sadducees from last week. Do you remember what they did? Give us another sign, Jesus. Give us another sign. They weren't convinced at all, and they had no intention of submitting to Jesus. And they will find one day that they have made a serious mistake of eternal consequences. Because whether we submit or not, Jesus is who he says he is. Now, we might say, well, I'd love to, but I just don't get it. I don't understand it. And actually, there's a reason for that. It's in verse 17. Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven." Now, here is an extraordinary point. In order to acknowledge Jesus, God himself has to work in your heart to give you spiritual insight. You can't work it out on your own. We are blind, and we need to be shown by God himself who Jesus is. God himself needs to heal our spiritual blindness. But that is not an excuse for doing nothing. Why not pray to the God you may or may not believe in that God would reveal Jesus to you? Take away your blindness, and then you can submit to him. To submit to him is a spiritual work of God, but it is something we must all do if we are to be in right relationship with God on Judgment Day. So I want to ask you very bluntly this morning, have you answered that question yet? It is the most important question you will ever answer in your lifetime. Other questions are important. Questions like, will you accept this job? Will you marry me? Will you move here? Will you do this or that? All those things might be life-changing. None are life-defining like this question. Who do you say I am? The majestic King of the universe is asking you today, what do you think of me? Will you submit to Jesus' majesty? He's the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Second question. Will you join in with Jesus' mission? Will you join in with Jesus' mission? Of course, you can't do that unless you've answered the first question. But following on from that question, from Peter's confession in verse 16, Jesus says some remarkable things about Peter in verses 18 to 20. And actually, a lot of these things have been greatly misunderstood, so we'll have a look at them together. Let's read from verse 18. "I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Now that phrase, on this rock I will build my church, has often been understood by the Catholic Church as a pointer to the fact that Peter is the infallible leader that Jesus established, and that infallible leadership carries on to the Pope today. Peter is the rock, and the rock is still the Pope. The problem with that, of course, is that Peter is not infallible. He is not without sin, as we're about to discover. And actually, the rest of the New Testament makes it clear that whilst Peter is really significant in the local church, the start of the church, and he takes a clear lead, The leadership of the church was spread around. It's also clear that the church isn't his, it's Jesus's. I will build my church, says Jesus, not leave it to Peter and the popes. There is no hint here at all that Jesus is thinking of some sort of succession planning, which begins with Peter and goes on through the papacy. This passage doesn't support that. Actually, frankly, no passage supports that. But it is clear that Peter does have some key role involved in mind. Jesus is making a pun on Peter's name. Now, his name in Greek, Petros, means rock. So Jesus says, on you, Rocky, I am going to build my church. His confession about Jesus, his key place in the start of the church, is what Jesus is talking about. Acts 1-15, if you read that at your leisure later on, shows how foundational Peter really was in the foundation of the church. I'm going to build my church on you, says Jesus, the leader of the apostles, as you confess your faith in me, along with all the other apostles. If you like, Peter is first among equals. He doesn't rival Jesus. He definitely doesn't surpass him. Jesus is the founder. It's his church. He's the king. But Peter does play a key role. But notice a couple of things about this church that Jesus is setting up. First, it's a church that prevails. It is a church that prevails. Now, the church in the New Testament is the gathering of all God's people across space and time, all believers, Old Testament and New Testament, who trust in the promises of God and see those promises fulfilled in the work of Jesus. The church is all of his gathered saved people. Now, this little church here, All Saints, which happens to be meeting this morning, is one local manifestation of that universal church. Incidentally, it's just worth saying, occasionally when we say the creed from time to time here at All Saints, we often say we believe in one holy Catholic church. And often people say, do we mean the Catholic denomination? No, it's Catholic with a small c, which simply means universal, the complete gathering of God's people. Not Catholic, big C, which is the denomination. The creed is talking about what Jesus is saying here, his complete gathering of his people, his universal Catholic church, founded on Peter and the apostles and their confession of Jesus. Catholic with a small C, notice. But notice verse 17, the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Hades is a picture of death, and its gates are holding people captive. But the gates of death, Hades, are no match for this supernatural gathering of God's people. Death itself cannot overcome the church. The church will stand forever because God's people are Jesus's people. It's his church. Jesus holds the power of life and death because he's died and risen again. He's supreme. Nothing and no one can defeat him and therefore defeat his church. Now that is a massive encouragement to us this morning. So many political regimes and leaders and individuals have attacked and continue to attack God's church, quite literally in some countries. If you remember, one of our mission partners is the Barnabas Fund. We support them as a church family. We often pray about very difficult situations that believers are facing in different parts of the world, persecution against God's church. But is the church destroyed? Answer, no. And even if God's people are killed, they rise again to new life and enjoy God's perfect life in God's perfect kingdom. God's people always have the last laugh over their enemies because they're in Christ. Again and again over the last few decades, atheist commentators and authors like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, have predicted the end of Christianity in our nation, even in the world. But here's a funny thing. The church still stands, and it's growing, as it is all over the world. And especially in places where persecution comes from Muslim or atheist or other religious regimes. Think of some countries, Iran, China, Laos, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, India, parts of South America, many parts of Eastern Europe. We have representatives from those nations in our congregation this morning. All over the world, Jesus' church is growing. The gates of Hades cannot overcome it. And don't ever think that in our land, God's church will die out. We may go through some very testing times. That is quite likely, I think. But it's Jesus' church. Satan and his forces will never prevail. Take courage from that. We are on the winning side. It's a foregone conclusion that Jesus will win. He's already had the victory already because he's risen. He's got the victory. The church is secure. And notice too, the church of Jesus is a church that proclaims. It prevails, but it also proclaims. And that, I think, is what is being explained in what we might think at first is some obscure words in verse 19. Jesus says to Peter, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loose in heaven." Keys in the Bible are signs of royal authority, and the king would entrust the keys to his faithful steward to look after things for him. And here, Peter is entrusted with the keys of the kingdom of the Messiah. He's the Messiah's steward in that sense. But as the key holder, he simply relays the decision that has already been taken in heaven. The binding and the loosing here refers to the message of the gospel, as men and women are set free as they respond to the message about Jesus, or they are bound as they reject it. So as Peter and the apostles teach about Jesus, hearts are set free, and sadly, some hearts are bound. But the power is Jesus's. The instruments to speak the message are the apostles. But that message doesn't stop with the apostles. It carries on with us, the church of Jesus. Matthew 28 sees Jesus sending his disciples out into the world to the very end of the age. And we are enjoying that privilege today as we carry on that work to the very end of the age. It is a remarkable privilege to speak the message of Jesus. And as we speak it, both from the pulpit and as we as individuals speak it to friends, families, neighbours, all that sort of thing, the message goes out, hearts are released, they're freed as they submit to Jesus, and sadly some reject him and they are bound. But the power to free or judge comes from Jesus, not us. We are just the instruments, the mouthpieces. But what a privilege that is. What great news we have to share, that in Jesus, the majestic King, there is freedom from slavery to sin and Satan and death, that in Jesus there is safety for all eternity. And Matthew asks us, will you get on board with that mission? And frankly, can you think of a better mission to be part of? Nothing is as rewarding or fantastic as being involved in the mission of Jesus and his church, don't you think? Third question, will you walk Jesus's way? And in verse 21, the tone changes rather abruptly. Because the question is, well, what kind of Messiah will Jesus be? What kind of king is he? And the answer is, a king that Peter isn't really, he doesn't really like it, as we'll see. Because the answer is a suffering king. Let's read from verse 21. "From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." From that time on, says Matthew, this is a new stage in Jesus' ministry. From this point on, he's going to explain for the rest of the gospel how he will gather his church, which is by dying for his people and rising again. The Messiah must die to save his people. That is how the church is born into existence. And Jesus will explain this several more times before he actually goes to the cross. Notice he says, I must go to Jerusalem to die. Must in terms of this is God's plan and I submit to it. This is what God has been planning for his son all along, to fulfill the prophecies and to save his people. But it's not something the disciples understand yet, which is why, incidentally, verse 20, I wonder if you were confused by that. It's an odd thing to say, isn't it? Don't tell others. When he's just been saying there's good news to share. But they don't understand what kind of Messiah he is yet, and they won't until after the cross and resurrection. For now, they've only got half the story. He's the Messiah, but they don't understand he's a suffering Messiah. It's only half the gospel. Half a gospel will confuse people and maybe even derail the mission. No, Jesus has to go to the cross and rise again before they understand the whole of Jesus' identity and person. So, keep it quiet for now, he says, in this particular context. And the fact they misunderstand is painfully revealed by Peter. Verse 22, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, he said. This shall never happen to you. Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, and you do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Must have been a bit of a shock to Peter to hear this, mustn't it? And also a shock to hear Jesus talking in words of verse 21. And so he takes it on himself, good old Peter, to try and stop Jesus from doing it. Full marks for good intentions, no marks for getting it right, because he can't see what kind of Messiah Jesus is. How will Jesus rescue? He has to die on a cross for sinners like Peter, and for you, and for me. And Jesus' reply is very blunt. Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. Four verses earlier, he was the foundation stone. Now he's the stumbling stone. And notice Jesus says he's Satan. Not literally Satan, but he's definitely doing Satan's work. Right at the start of his ministry, Jesus was tempted by Satan to bypass the cross, to take the glory of the nations now instead of the pain of the cross. Glory now, no suffering. That was Satan's temptation. But the way to rescue is suffering now, glory later. And Satan wants to stop that happening, both in the desert temptations, back in chapter 3 and 4, and here through Peter. Because he knows, Satan knows, his downfall is the cross. No, to save his people and defeat Satan, Jesus has to go to the cross. And for Peter, or anyone else for that matter, to think something else of Jesus is, well, it's not right. It's not of God. It's human thinking. The cross is foolishness to the world, but it's the wisdom of God. It turns human wisdom on its head, doesn't it? It's God's way of saving us, and Satan hates it. And more than that, there's a very big shock for us in verses 24 and 26. Just glance down, please, at those verses. Verse 24, Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their souls? Do you see the shock? To follow the Savior, you have got to carry your cross. To be his disciple, to receive his rescue, means walking his way. The way of the cross. The way of the cross is not about giving up chocolate for Lent or doing dry January or putting up with your mother-in-law or a bunion or something like that. That is not what Jesus means when he says, bear your cross. The only people carrying crosses in Jesus' day were on a one-way journey to death. When Jesus says, take up your cross, he means, follow me to death. Put me first. And the irony is, if you cling on to your life in this life, you will lose it for all eternity. If you stubbornly say no to Jesus and cling on to your life, you will lose it forever when you meet Jesus on Judgment Day. But here's the beautiful thing. If you hand over your life to him, allow him control of your life, in handing it over, you gain it. Your life is in the king's hands. He's never going to let you go. But to follow him means to follow Jesus' way, the way of the cross. And frankly, says Jesus, what good is it if you gain the whole world even, but forfeit your soul? That is why our decision about Jesus is the biggest decision of our lives. Nothing else matters more than getting right with God and receiving his forgiveness in Jesus. Over 25 years as a pastor, I've done my fair share of funerals. One of the very saddest I ever did was of a man who had taken early retirement, and he and his wife decided to travel the world. They had amazing plans, but they did one or two holidays, and on one holiday, they got back from holiday, walked into the door, and he just dropped dead from a heart attack. He was in his early 60s, if I remember right. I went to visit his wife, and she showed me their travel photos all over the world, cruises here, there, and everywhere. In many ways, he'd gained the whole world. He was financially secure, but he forfeited his soul. So tragic. What good is that, says Jesus? Friends, may none of us make that same mistake. Far better to live a life of faithful service to Jesus than to gain the whole world, if you possibly can, and ignore him, because you'll forfeit your soul. But I just want to challenge us on this point, because I think even if we are believers, there is a very serious challenge here, because how many of us actually want to take up our crosses and follow Jesus? How many of us actually find it pleasurable necessarily to say no to self and yes to Jesus? No to our pleasure and comfort. Yes to sacrificial self, Jesus-centered ministry. Because the character of our generation is entitlement, isn't it? I deserve this, people say. The holiday, the meal out, the bigger car, the nicer house, the me time. And none of that is necessarily bad. But here's the thing, it is not ours by rights. All of those things are gifts from our Creator. And the danger is, even as believers, we can swallow the entitlement culture and believe it for ourselves. It's really dangerous. It affects, for example, how we view serving in church. There are certain things we might think that are beneath us. We're better than that. It affects how we give ourselves to each other. I want to help, but I just need to protect myself. And of course, there's some wisdom there. But how often does entitlement trump godly, sacrificial service? Personally, I find these verses in 24 to 26 deeply challenging, and I think our current Christian culture is a very long way from taking this really seriously. I don't want us to make us feel unduly guilty. We serve because we're set free to serve, not to earn God's favor. I just don't want to water down this passage. It's about following Jesus with our own safe parameters, we're in danger of saying. And Jesus is saying something much stronger. Take up your cross and follow me. Death to you, life in me. Death to entitlement, follow the crucified Lord. If Jesus had considered his rights, thought himself entitled to security and pleasure, it would be the death of us all. Will you walk Jesus his way? Now, our time has gone, but I just want to end with one final question. And that is, will you live in the light of Jesus' return? Because do you notice how he ends in verse 27? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. Verse 27 puts all the other verses into perspective. Notice the four at the start of the verse. Our decision to follow Jesus is vital for he is coming back, because there is a day when Jesus will return in glory, and all the decisions we have made in this life will be seen for what they really are. It is only as Jesus is seen for who he really is that other things are seen for what they really are. It's why a cross-shaped life actually makes sense in an entitlement culture. Because when the king comes, he will reward faithful service. And actually, on a weekend when we remember 2 years of fighting in Ukraine, isn't it a great encouragement to know that there is an end, that Jesus will return to bring justice, to hold everyone to account? That is so vital to hold on to today. And because Jesus is coming back, I want to side with the king, even if it does mean death for self, because I know I'm on the side of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. We need to live in the light of the king's return, follow his path of cross-shaped discipleship. It's the only life worth living. It's the only way to save ourselves. Submit to Jesus. Walk his way. Let's pray. Lord, you do teach us some difficult things because you love us and you long for us to live lives of wholehearted servant-heartedness, fulfillment in Christ. I pray for each and every one of us, first and foremost, that we would answer that question, who is Jesus, and respond, you are the Messiah. And then with courage and strength and your power and strength at work in us, help us to live godly, sacrificial lives for your name's sake. Amen.